Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
I found it was interesting that, you know, traditionalists in this area that study teams would note the change as a problem. For us, I think it can really be a strategic advantage, especially if, like, you care about the well-being of people. For example, whenever somebody is the only owner of a system and that system goes down, they're going to get the phone calls. It's going to be hard to take time off and have a good work-life balance. Sometimes when we add people to a team or try to create some kind of redundancy through team change, it can improve the quality of people's lives because they're not the only one that knows the system.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, David?
I'm fine. Things are getting hot in Costa Rica. The weather is going up like 2 degrees, and that is hot for me. So we are hot. It's too hot. But it's good. All good. Ready for today's episode.
Excellent. Yeah, this was a really good conversation. We live in this world of constant change. Technology is always changing. The economy changes. People change jobs. Programming languages we work with change. Even my car downloads software updates at night right now. I mean, change is constant and it's all around us and our teams are no exception. So while we might strive for creating stable and consistent teams, the reality is it's not possible to maintain those stable teams for very long. And so instead of being reactive to team changes, how can we more proactively harness change in teams for good? I think that's the topic of our conversation today with Heidi Helfand, author of Dynamic Reteaming. What did you find interesting about this conversation with Heidi? Anything you want our listeners to look out for?
Yes. I think that we've been lacking for the whole time a framework to look at reteaming, changing teams, and all the possible changes that could happen when you have a team. And the conversation initiates in a very interesting way. It's like we've been always under the premise that what you need to reach always in the agile teams is predictability by having consistency and the same people always.
Right.
And that is primed us, and that has primed us to evade the that factor reality of changing teams. Changing the composition. So, oh my God, it is a good episode. I particularly liked the conclusion that at some point we reached that the importance to think short term, but also long term, and how to balance that. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, good episode. Very good episode.
Yeah, I think it really was. It challenged me in a few areas, such as when, how, or if you would ever split up a high-performing team for knowledge transfer. I really enjoyed that part. And also we wrapped up a little conversation, a comparison between teams and guacamole, and any discussion of avocados is going to stick with me. And I thought it was a great, great simile. So let's get to our interview with Heidi Helfand. Heidi Helfand is the author of the book Dynamic Reteaming. She coaches software development teams using practical people-focused techniques with the goal of building resilient organizations as they double and triple in size. Her 20-plus career in tech helped launch Procore Technologies and AppFolio to IPO and Expert City to acquisition by Citrix. She was on the original development team that built GoToMeeting and GoToWebinar. Heidi's based in Southern California. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Heidi.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I definitely enjoyed the book, so looking forward to this conversation. I'm going to start with the subtitle of your book I really like. It's The Art and Wisdom of Changing Teams. So tell us a little bit more about your career and what led you to realize the wisdom of changing teams.
Yeah, so as you said in my intro, I've been in this industry for 20 some years, and I've been in a variety of roles, from individual contributor to director to most recently VP of engineering. And one thing I know is true: our team compositions change. It's a matter of nature. People come, people go. It's also a matter of deliberate changes that maybe we want to have happen to attain a variety of goals, like building new products, for example. And I think there is an art and wisdom to it. It's challenging territory, especially when we're trying to catalyze changes in our teams. It's not easy. And I really wanted to dig into this material when I wrote this book, because a lot of the books that you see behind me might say that, no, the goal is to get some people, put them in a team, keep them the same, and then maybe through time you can attain a high performing team. And that was just like negated my career. I mean, I was like 10th employee at one company and one startup. I left when there were about 600. We went from one team to 20 or 30 teams in my tenure there in engineering product development. And we configured and reconfigured as we went. And then we deliberately reteamed to do things like share information. So yeah, the art and wisdom in changing teams, it's not like install this perfect org design and you're there. It's a little more nuanced than that. It's a lot of more nuanced than that, because we're dealing with people. And yeah, we all have preferences. And so how can we grow, change, morph our orgs to attain goals without, you know, completely getting everybody mad at us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, we do romanticize the notion of stable teams, and we all want that. And it's very attractive, this notion that we can design and build a team from the start and it's going to stay that way indefinitely. And so along those lines, I also liked how early in your book you started with this premise that changeable teams are still teams. So I'd love to have you expand a little bit on that phrase, and why are we often resistant to change in our teams?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I started a newsletter recently, and I've been working each morning on this newsletter episode edition for this week. And I was reviewing some of the literature on Tuchman's model for teams, you know, forming, storming, norming, performing, and later adjoining, which was added with his co-author, Marianne C. Jensen. And in it, he talks about, they were doing review of the literature of different types of groups from industries other than software, but they encountered a problem with one of the studies that they were looking at. And the problem was that, well, they couldn't complete all of the stages because they had people joining the team. And I looked at that and I was like, wow, that's probably the most fascinating thing about this particular article, because what do you mean that's a problem? That's like what happens in the world. We have onboarding programs and other things. It's reality. Now, again, they were researching groups of people that were in group therapy. They were training groups, like with an HR or kind of centralized classroom kind of training group, and then some other what they call natural groups or laboratory groups. So they were studying groups that were other than our kind of changeable software teams, where I think, you know, we've got a lot more going on. But I found it was interesting that, you know, traditionalists in this area that study teams would note the change as a problem. For us, I think it can really be a strategic advantage, especially if, like, you care about the well-being of people. For example, whenever somebody is the only owner of a system and that system goes down, they're going to get the phone calls. It's going to be hard to take time off and have a good work-life balance. Sometimes when we add people to a team or try to create some kind of redundancy through team change, it can improve the quality of people's lives because they're not the only one that knows the system, right? And then that later, they're not going to want to work on that system forever. I think as humans, we like to learn different things. you're not going to university to get in one class for 5 years and like dominate that material. You're going to have different teachers, different classes, different students. You're going to change. In the same way, I think we can devise reteaming tactics to enable people to have futures which are richer because they get to do other things and aren't kind of like the only one with the particular feature. So yeah, I think, you know, changing can be definitely a strategic advantage. If the person doesn't want the change, it can be a completely different thing and harder to deal with. If the person doesn't want to have somebody join them and work on the system, if somebody doesn't want to switch, you know, there's different, like, those are some of the nuances and the challenges in, you know, what I would call dynamic org design, in that we have human factors that play a part. We have organizational needs. We have the system that we're cultivating and caring for and looking after. There's a lot of different things going on. So
yeah, absolutely. David, you look deep in thought, and I can, and we deal with changing teams a lot, so I can see your wheels exactly. Turning.
Exactly. Every time that we encounter or we engage a new client, here's a new client, what we've discovered is that we are creating or triggering a reteaming event for the client because we are bringing new people. We do that. And we've seen all kinds of different situations where, I don't know, maybe the new people that we are bringing in, it is, let's say, one developer from Brazil now is just finding its way to get into a already established team of workers in the United States. And that is not that complicated. But sometimes we are bringing more people, or maybe 10 people, let's say, or 20 people. And now that's interesting because now the company in the United States, they have already fewer teams, but now all that knowledge and all that expertise and all the leadership has to be reconfigured to accommodate all these new people. And so that change and that reteam and that challenge, it is something that we've seen commonly. It is an important topic, and I like the fact that your premise is this: why are we acting like this is bad or this is not happening? I mean, it is reality, right?
Yeah.
So I love it. I love it.
Yeah. And, you know, if I remember at that startup where I was the 10th employee, and I had formed and directed a group of coaches, and we were helping the teams, you know, become more productive, whatever it was. And I remember that, you know, we'd read some of these books and we'd think about, like, how can we be of service to these teams, not focusing on the fact that people were coming and going and we were doubling in size would have been detrimental to the company, to the growth. It would have been counterproductive to be like, the best teams are the stable ones. No, like, that's not useful in this context with where 20 people are arriving one day. I remember the day that we got, like, it was an internship program in the summer. 20 people arrived. I made sure they all had smoothies. We had an event together. They had mentors. The mentors came. We had a mixer with the mentors and the people that were just joining. Like, we had a very deliberate, planned onboarding of these 20 people. And it was different than the one-off, oh, one person is joining. You know, there's a special checklist and like the things that we did. Like, we designed, I co-designed what was going to happen with these 20 people. It was a wave in the system. Where are they going to go? What are they going to focus on? Like, what, like, these are like some of the real challenges that we have. And so, you know, what, early on when I was writing this book, I really just wanted to prove the point. Team change is real. It's inevitable. Let's focus there. Let's shift our lens. If we're looking out of a telescope, we don't need to look at the lens of some of this, you know, academic stability. It would be great. It would be nice if it were so easy. It would be nice if we could just get these people together, let time pass, maybe apply some coaching, and then suddenly they're performing. Like they're, you know, it's great. That would be very convenient. But in the real world, like the one that you're talking about here, like the one I'm writing about, it's more like we have different kinds of challenges. So how can we be of service to these companies that have these different challenges that sometimes result in the change of teams? You know, it's not, my talks have started reorgs. That's not my goal. It's not change for change's sake. It's more like we're going to have some challenges sometimes. Reteaming is one way to address a challenge. It's not the only way. There might be other things that you need to do as well. So I'm not saying change for the sake of changing, but what I am saying is that sometimes we'll get ourselves into situations through fast growth. These days, a lot of attrition. Teams are probably merging together. Right? It's kind of the opposite of the grow and split is the merging of teams. So I imagine we see a lot more merging and a lot more, you know, people having more responsibility than they did before because people are leaving and they're not necessarily, you know, filling their spot. So like, how can we face these challenges and build software companies that deliver value or working on the right thing? Knowledge is staying in the house. You know, it's a whole space that I find very rich and fascinating and very challenging. You know, I find it very challenging. So.
Now, before I leave this topic or this subtopic, what you're saying is that it emphasizes or make it more important the following is. The role of that person could be like the VP of engineering, someone like that, that is in charge and has the accountability and the empowerment to address these decisions up front. I mean, that it is not afraid to deal with this and has the power from the top to do this. The cases where we've seen that it's not working in some organization is that no one wants to take care of it. Like it's like they don't want to, they know they want to grow, but they don't want to deal with the challenges that growing implies. So my point is, how important is to have someone with the empowerment and accountability to execute and manage these scenarios, right?
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. In some organizations, it might be a VP of engineering, it might be a director, you know, depending on the size of the organization and title. But, you know, a lot of us are in the business of delivering software, of creating these really cool things for our customers that our customers pay for and that they love. So delivery is really, you know, the primary emphasis that we might hear of. However, as we're doing this, a lot of the times it's a movable, changeable environment. So we need to also get better at managing a lot of this change, cultivating the change, you know, really like kind of surfing these waves of change so that we yield different benefits, like the knowledge stays in the house, more than one team has the capacity to do something. Like, how can we, there's a lot of risk management. Like, how do we cultivate people knowing each other and feeling like they belong when they arrive at a company and they've never been a part of the company before? And maybe they have a different status. Maybe they're a contractor and not a full-time. Like, how do we help people feel like they belong and that they're part of the group? That needs to be part of the conversation, like managing, you know, all of this stuff in addition to the delivery. And I know, and I have empathy for executives that, you have delivery deadlines. You need to meet these goals. That's one of the biggest gifts that I had from being a VP of engineering was being part of a C-suite and having that empathy and having that responsibility that we need to deliver. And that's really, really key. But at the same time, there are human factors and there are people to take care of. And there is this dynamic org that you need to cultivate and, you know, keep healthy at the same time. Like, you know, but I think there is a lot of emphasis on just the delivery and it needs to be both. So,
Well, I mean, deliveries, it is important to think short term, but if you don't think long term, you will run out of short term things to do sooner or later, yeah. Right?
Agree.
Now, remote work has significantly changed the dynamics of team structures and compositions. This means that team members can be dispersed across different regions and countries. So, in your opinion, how has the remote work changed the dynamics of team structures and compositions, and what are the implications of dynamic reteaming?
Yeah, time zones can obviously be challenging. When I map out in organizations and the teams within it, I like to do it with like a Excel spreadsheet, and you can put the people and what are the time zone locations of all the people. It can be challenging if there's only an hour of overlap or 2 hours of overlap. And you have to, if that's the case and you can't get around that, you need to adapt the way that you're working to be more asynchronous, right? How do you cultivate those personal connections where people know and care about each other? It's definitely a barrier, and it's more difficult. I think there's an advantage to when you have people that are working in similar time zones. So what do you do? It depends on the challenges you're facing in particular. Do you have teams of people in like time zones? Do you have a work shifting kind of situation? Just, like I was saying, cultivate the asynchronous. I think we'll have unique challenges that we have to face. So, and there's a variety of solutions, of which looking at your team compositions is a lever. It's one of many levers to look at. It doesn't solve everything to like, all right, put them all, the people in the same time zones and the same teams. That doesn't necessarily help you, especially if they don't have the expertise to work on whatever you're doing. I feel like we're talking very abstractly, but I think, we're communicating here and we're connecting and we have our video on. That's helpful. We can connect to a certain degree. There's nothing that compares to meeting people in person. Strategically meeting in person at the team level is an investment that I believe is worth the money. You don't need to get 500 people together or 150 people together as much as the closest unit of people working together. If you can get them together a few times a year, I think you'll be at an advantage, just because it's an opportunity to have shared experiences that people talk about later. And that can be a form of currency, I think, for team development. If they got together and they went to an escape room, they did a challenge together, they're going to remember that shared experience and any kind of notable funny things that happened. Did you do that?
We did that. In Sao Paulo, Brazil. That was fun.
What was that like for you?
In fact, before I go there, we are going to have in a couple of weeks, Erin, we are going to have a get together activity in Panama with
our
clients from the United States with the Brazilian guys. But we did escape room.
Yeah.
And we finished it just with 3 seconds left. The fact is that we had already some caipirinhas inside, so it was quite difficult to solve the puzzles, but it was fun. Yeah, so doing this from time to time is something that builds a sense of belonging and trust.
Shared memory. I remember doing an escape room when I was at a company. We acquired another company. And so we were, the people were getting to know each other and getting folded into some of the teams. And having that escape room was a way to really bring the offices together. And I remember so many particulars about that, the personalities of different people shining through when facing whatever challenge it was.
So. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, especially because that one that we did in Sao Paulo was very multilingual. We had English, Spanish, and Portuguese speakers involved. I think the clues were in Portuguese, which didn't help me very much. I could have done okay maybe in Spanish, but not so much Portuguese, especially given we had some caipirinhas already at the restaurant.
Right.
As you mentioned. But it definitely strong memories from it. You know, it was a great experience. You mentioned... a couple of patterns earlier. You mentioned grow and split and merge, and you go through a series of patterns in your book, which I think is really interesting. I'd like to maybe talk about two scenarios that you also kind of hinted at already and kind of get your take on, you know, what's the pattern that you would apply to that and, you know, anything else you want to add to that. So the first scenario is kind of like David said, let's, you know, imagine that we have a company with an internal engineering staff of 40. They bring in someone like us and go with an idea of we're going to add in 20 outside engineers kind of all at once. And feel free to say that's a bad idea if you know, if you think so. But let's, you know, 40 people in the existing team, we add in 20 at once. What type of pattern would you look at for dynamic reteaming there?
And yeah, so I'll just... That it's pretty abstract, so I'll just talk about what comes to mind.
Sure.
So one of the patterns in the book is grow and split. And it's essentially, let's say you already have some teams and then you add team members. And after a while, when it feels like the teams, when things are taking longer, the work that they're doing is diverging, people aren't listening to each other, it feels a bit unwieldy. There's some additional ideas in the book, you split them into two teams. So they have a shared base of knowledge for whatever they were building and then split them into two teams. It's one kind of high growth pattern that I've seen over and over. And, you know, I'm doing these hand motions because, you know, that's what it's like. Sometimes when you grow and split, you have other challenges. Like, are you creating dependencies between these two teams? Mm-hmm. Did you have a good kind of separation of concerns so that they can actually be independent? Do you have people that are in enough roles on both teams that you're not just creating this condition where roles like product managers, quality, or design suddenly have double the amount of planning in other Zoom meetings? Could you split them in half? Like, there's some concerns for specialist roles when you do that. None of this is perfect, but... So grow and split comes to mind. Now, isolation pattern is another one that comes to mind. Let's say you're bringing in these people to catalyze and work on a new product. Then I would keep them separate and they would work, you know, maybe with some people seated in from the original company that have domain knowledge that they need. Doing something like that, like if we think about it and kind of like try to poke holes in it, that will create a separate kind of feel or vibe in the company and kind of a division. So that is an interesting one. Now, if you're trying to get away from the ways of working of the original company, like maybe it's very challenging, it's not working out, it's really not what you're going for. Cultivating something new on the side and building it there and then adding people in and growing from there might be something to consider. It's kind of like, what's going on in the current base? What are they working on? A lot of the times, I think with the isolation pattern also, like if you're coming in to work on something completely new or different, you might be in this discovery phase of product development where you need rapid feedback loops and you're building small prototypes and you're testing them and you're iterating rapidly because your directions could really change. Doing that in the context of a team that's working in regular cycles of like a week or 2 weeks, maintaining existing stuff, that's like too slow. And it's like a mismatch of these cadences. So you want to keep them separate so this team can fly, not be, you know, not just be working in a development spike on something brand new that requires quicker iteration. And they're like really like, it's like inappropriate cadence mismatch there. I would also wonder why that big number, why 20, why not like four, and spread them out and have them you know, one thing that I love the concept of, and I really wanted to do this in a previous role was, so we have, you know, for example, if you have your established teams and you're going to bring in, let's say 5 or 6 people and spread them out, have them get context, understand what's going on. After a while, then maybe it's from your company or from the existing, like, cultivate a leadership role for the people that you're bringing in, and maybe they become a lead and more people are added and they mm-hmm. become like they have career growth as well, that they're not just sort of becoming, you know, part of the IC pool of the teams, but that we cultivate their career growth with some kind of lead position and they're integrated somehow. That was one of the thoughts that kind of came to me because I have empathy for that. And, you know, it's, I understand, and it's, you know, trying to like, how can we help everyone grow and grow together and have career growth. So that's interesting to me, but you know, it's a big wave in the system to bring 20 people over. And, you know, if you already have like 500 people, maybe that's less noticeable or less right. of a wave in the system, but do you really need to do that? I'm not so sure that I think you could do it. It's one of these things that I liked. There's a chapter in my book towards the end that talks about planning larger scale reteamings. And so this is like the kind of thing, like starting a document, like this is a challenge we're trying to solve. This is the current state of the teams. This is the proposed future state, and like really drawing it out, whiteboarding it out. These are the challenges that we're facing and how we plan to address them. This is our execution plan and our timeline. Mm-hmm. These are the different solutions that we've considered. It's almost like, you know, we're building a new design. Like what are, you know, let's have a, you know, you could have like a, what do you call those? There was a word from UX that you could have a design studio for mm-hmm. your org, right? And people come up with different ideas. So you diverge, and then there's pros and cons of each solution. And which one are you going to go with? We can do that with reteamings, especially ones that sounds very expensive, sounds very costly, sounds like a big disruption for the company. We can't take it lightly. Mm-hmm. So there's some planning tools in the book, which like go into some of this. And you know, the whole matter of how are you going to message that? What's the narrative? How are you going to communicate that? And a planning group might be talking about a big change for months, and then they're impatient, right? This is where leaders need to have patience, because then you're adding more people into the conversation. They're just hearing about it for the first time, but you're tired of talking about it because you've been designing it with this small group for so long. But here is where you need to leaders need to have patience and stop and like slowly proceed forward. And, you know, it's a whole thing with how are you going to communicate about this? What's going on? What's the schedule? People are going to be surprised. People don't get the message. Patrick Lencioni in his book, The Advantage, talks about people need to be chief reminding officers. You need to say something 7 or more times. I would add that you need to do it in different communication channels. And it's probably a remote thing. So then we have that additional barrier. Like right. this stuff is hard. So we need to carefully and methodically plan and execute any kind of large scale, you know, wave in the system.
Yeah, I appreciate the pushback on the idea of, you know, would you want to add 20 people to a 40 person team? For the sake of a, you know, an imperfect hypothetical, let's imagine that we are that 40 person startup who's achieved product market fit. We're, you know, getting a big wave of funding, and we know that over the course of the next 6 or 12 months to meet, you know, to complete our pipeline of new features, we're going to need a 50% growth in the team. If we take that as, you know, those assumptions as valid for the sake of discussion, would you rather add those 20 people kind of at once, or in like 4 groups of 5 over time? Like, how do you how do you control the, you know, I think you refer to it as creative destruction in your book about, you know, when you're proactively doing dynamic reteaming, how much is too much? How do you know that balance? And, you know, if you can control whether it's four groups of five or 20 at once, you know, do you have a preference?
Intuitively, I would probably go for the more gradual, if we have time for that. I don't know what kind of other pressures we're under to deliver. We don't want to break. We don't want to like break the whole thing. We don't want too much of a shock to the system. This is where a little bit of this remote stuff is kind of handy because people can't see it. People can't necessarily see what's happening. When I was telling you the story of the 20 interns that arrived in one day, we could all see them. We could feel it. It was a wave. We knew what was going on. You could kind of feel it in the environment. You could see all these people and there were all these new faces. You know, one thing about working in this distributed remote kind of world is you don't necessarily see all of that, right? So so that's a little bit different. I think whichever solution you have, whether you have the big group together that comes at once or the five, the most important thing is that you have a coherent strategy with your team, with your leadership team about what you're doing, and they're all bought into it, right? Mm-hmm. And then you talk about that. Like, these are the options that we have. Like, option A is with this, option B is with this. What's an option C? Like, you know, inviting the ideas that maybe the planning group didn't come up with, like trying to entertain other options. And really having a unified front and a coherent kind of together strategy of how you're going to go about it. Because then, yeah, like that ownership of the dynamic org design is huge because people will be behind it. People, right? And even getting more voices heard in the situation, like the people in the teams, if you're spreading people into existing teams, like, What do the managers think? Like trying to include different perspectives is really important. There's a whiteboard reteaming story and chapter and probably activities in my book that, you know, at one point I was involved in a large reteaming of about, I don't know, 60 to 80 people. We visualized it on whiteboards. We were in person, so we could do that. You could do it with online tools as well and like cultivate that kind of community. But I think the most important thing is that the group that is supporting it and in on it, they're all like, yeah, this is the way. Let's do it this way. Let's try it. Also knowing that it's hard with this stuff. It might not all go perfectly. We're going to have challenges from this. We're going to meet on a regular cadence to talk about how it's going and like getting that. There's towards the end of my book, there's a chapter about retrospectives, like to build the capacity to do this and do this well, you need to talk about what's going on, face the challenges together, iterate on it. It's like another, you know, we have the software delivery going on, but then we have these other changes. It's like another layer in Photoshop, right? That we can't ignore. And we need our retrospectives there too.
So I'm hearing, I'm drawing a couple, sorry, David. Two quick conclusions I think I'm drawing from what you're saying, and I just want to confirm with you. This is both top-down and grassroots to do dynamic reteaming effectively. You know, you've got some central planning going on, but then you're also building in an opportunity for feedback from the team. And on top of that, that's why it's also beneficial to maybe go with four waves of five people instead of one wave of 20 is that you've built in a certain amount of iteration to that and an opportunity for the team to say, we messed up a little bit with the first five. This part didn't go smooth. Let's try this instead with the next group of five people that we add in.
Yeah, I like that. That, you know, well, it's interesting. If we think of product development in small groups, what about org design in smaller groups and then iterations, learning, applying? I like that.
Yeah. And the other thing is I never seen a reteaming of 20 new people where all the 20 were successfully synchronized and attended to fully. I mean, it's quite difficult to really keep everybody busy and engaged if so many of them are not updated into the process or not onboarded. So it's anyway, totally. It's possible, but it's quite
totally challenging. Getting them 20 computers is a hard thing to do,
right?
Or they didn't get the right computer, or this one didn't work. I mean, those are like real tactical things that I'm sure you've dealt with, right? Like getting people equipment is...
Yeah, and then try getting that equipment to Brazil.
Yeah.
Oh, don't get me started. Yeah.
That's a separate episode for David.
That's a separate episode, yeah.
That's a separate, trying to get them t-shirts. Like, that's hard too. Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
I have, for me at least, a last question. It is, after a reteaming event, once the decision has been made, do you pay attention to specific things or specific metrics or indicators of success to keep track of how this thing is doing, how the reteaming is working?
Like, did we do the right thing? Did we
we
added all these people? Are we delivering our product? I think it gets back to what we might already be looking at for delivery. Are we now adding new people causes a slowdown until they're ramped up and then they get up to speed and then they're delivering things. And, you know, that takes a different amount of time. I'm more into qualitative feedback, but there is a dip in productivity to ramp people up and to get them productive. Like, and I don't think it's valuable to really, you know, we want them to ideally be contributing to the code base as soon as they can, but what's the quality of what they're delivering? You know, it's like, you can't rush the, there's a lot that goes into it. So I think it's, what does the delivery look like after a while? Are we productive in producing software? Some people like to look at there's the space framework and the DORA metrics. And what are your, you know, maybe we already have kind of these dashboards that track how we're delivering as software teams. So we still look at those as well with the reteaming stuff, but know that stuff is, things are going to be slowed for a while until people, you know, understand what they're doing. I think also maybe we already have regular engagement surveys or feedback from people. I think that's another thing. We can do surveys and get feedback on the reteaming and how it went from the people that were involved in it. And those voices are important to incorporate in future. You're going to see, I mean, definitely with departures these days and companies downsizing, their engagement surveys are going to be filled with a ton of pain. So you're going to see that. So, you know, that's a whole different topic. Like, that type of reteaming and dismissing takes months to get over for the people that are still there in the company. We focus, and we should, helping people, you know, land new jobs and other things. But there's also a lot of internal pain when that happens and a lot of loss. And so that, you know, how did that go? Did it go better? You know, like some... we can see things playing out on LinkedIn and people, you can see, oh, I didn't like how that executive did that. Oh, I love how this one did that. You'll see a lot of opinion sharing about that. If you pay attention, I've been paying attention to that a bit because this, I mean, that's like one of the I can't imagine what it's like to plan and execute that. And I have not done that. I've, you know, witnessed and been a part of these things, but, very, very challenging. You know, on the opposite, and the whole growth scenarios, sounds like the good old days where we have this funding, we have a lot of money, we're adding people. It's a whole different vibe. And yeah, we get, how do we iterate and get better at our onboarding? What do the people say that we're were going through the onboarding? What did the people think that were managing the onboarding? So different surveys, retrospectives, qualitative feedback, the, you know, standard engagement surveys. Are we delivering? What do our numbers look like that we look at anyway all the time? Stuff like that.
It's so interesting what you say, because I conclude that one important thing here is something that you're indirectly stressing is that are we taking the time to understand what are the reasonable expectations about this? Even if we are reducing the team or we are growing the teams. I mean, what are the reasonable expectations about this?
Yeah.
And particularly with the scenario that you said about reducing the team because of all these financial scenario. What I've seen is that the reduction is going with a lot of uncertainty and fear with the people that stay. And mm-hmm. and that is reducing the capacity to assess this, the expectations. So it is like people being numb because of what is going on, that they don't have enough bandwidth to think about this is a good time to assess what is going on and compare with expectations, or maybe it's time to adjust expectations or not. But yeah, I mean, I just wanted to understand that part. I mean, the expectation part is important.
And expectations on delivery. Like if suddenly you reduced the workforce and a lot of the team members that they relied on are now gone, or particular roles are eliminated and other people have to take them on. One, it's traumatic. Maybe they were your friends. Maybe you used to have lunch with them. Maybe you had the coffee on the Zoom every day to start your day in stand up, and they wore that funny hat on Thursdays. Like there's a big loss for people that are still there. Yet a lot of the goals are still the same. You have to deliver. The customers are waiting. We have to make money. It's like all this stuff. Like people need to take time to process this stuff, talk about it. William Bridges wrote a book called Transitions. I have it right over here. My last newsletter talked about it a little bit. This book, Transitions, William Bridges. This is a good one to read when going through what he calls transitions, endings, the neutral zone, and the new beginning. The person that's, you know, laid off is going through an ending, and then a neutral zone is a period of uncertainty, and maybe the new beginning is starting something new. Maybe it's a new job, or they catalyze work. So they're going through the transition with a very abrupt ending for some of them, like we've seen play out Twitter and other things on the internet there. But then the people in the companies are also going through the ending, the neutral zone and the new beginning. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of loss, right? So there's the ending. Oh my gosh, they're not there anymore. Okay. Neutral zone. Like, what does this mean? Like, am I okay? Like how, like there's this whole thing. And then the new beginning, like after a while, you know, you move on. It takes time. It probably takes a different amount of time for different people. If I'm on a team and someone was laid off and they were on my immediate team, it's going to be probably a little bit different to get over than if they were on a different team. I never saw them in a Zoom call and it's more abstract. But it's like, this is like the human angle of all of this is very challenging. And I think this book helps both parties in this. And it would help the people that made the decisions about this change. It would help them. It's an interesting book for sure. And it doesn't have to do with software. It's talking about life transitions in general. But But yeah, that, you know, there's like that territory and it has a feel. And then there's this other territory of growth and newness and like, wow, bright future, which is another, you know, different kind of space. Then there's the, you know, maintaining the status quo, keeping the wheels on the bus and augmenting our staff kind of thing. So yeah, there's a lot of rich different territory in this dynamic reteaming space. And the book has these five patterns that you can apply when you're catalyzing a reteaming or when you're just going to encounter this stuff, because it's really just like a picture of what it's like to be in a dynamic changeable org. So I think it's almost like a piece of anthropological research in a way, because I derive the patterns based on real stories of how teams change. So I find the space to be very interesting. I really appreciate our conversation as well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it too. This has been a wonderful conversation. There's if we have time for two quick questions, to wrap up on my part. First, I want to just briefly touch on one of the anti-patterns that you mentioned in the book that I found very interesting. You called it a reteaming to spread high performance. And there's a story in there talking about a case where it was negative, a bad thing for a team to take a team of high performers and spread them around to try to spread knowledge, which I thought was very interesting because it, you know, challenges some assumptions I have that would usually be a good thing. You know, when is it a good idea? When is it a dangerous idea to take a team of high performers and spread them around?
Yeah, that was John's story in the book, and he regretted what he did. And he says that in there. And I remember this. And he thought the way that I could, like this one team, they were jamming, they were delivering this stuff. It was an enjoyable experience. It was like the vibe was like an amazing team experience. Like, sounds like one of the, like, if you look back on your career and you were working with those teams and you were like, you didn't want it to end. It was just almost magical. And he's like, well, I wanted this for these other teams also. So I thought I'll just take people out of here and here and, you know, pretty much kind of destroyed the dynamic. And kind of destroyed that feel that he, you know, it did the opposite of what he wanted. Now, so he personally was like, I regretted that. And then, you know, I got three teams and they were okay. But I found that to be an interesting story that he told me, because it was like, all right, well, what else could he have done besides reteaming in that case? Like, maybe, like one way that I think is great to share stories of awesome teams is something that many of us do anyway. You have a lunch and learn, or you have some kind of event where someone from that team is talking about what they do. Maybe it inspires another team. Maybe you could add, I wouldn't add more than one. Maybe you could use the switching pattern from the book, add one person into that team. Kind of see what it's like. Maybe they stay. Maybe then they go back and share what they learned and, you know, use that in their team. There's some research that's probably cited in this book about how if you switch for a short amount of time and then you go back, that benefits your team. It's research from Cornell or something. But yeah, there's like different things to try. Could it have worked? I don't know. You know, John's story is John's story, and it didn't work. Could it have worked for another one? I don't know. But I really, really, I wouldn't chance it, and I wouldn't bust up a team that was doing really, really well. So you don't, you know, I'm not saying like change your teams, use these patterns, go for it. It's more like, what challenges are you facing? Well, here's some levers to consider, and it's going to be hard. But here's some tools to help you kind of learn from it.
Thank you. That's a great insight. And I want to close with a quote you had in the book and ask, you know, a quick question on that, where you said, you can't make guacamole out of an unripe avocado. Sometimes teams and organizations aren't ready for change. So what if what if as a leadership team you feel like change is necessary in a positive or negative sense, but the team's not ready for change? How do you handle that? How do you ripen that avocado?
Yeah, it's hard to force things. I don't know if you've ever tried to make guacamole out of an unripe avocado, but it's very hard to do. With some creativity, you could probably try to influence that. So I think, you know, really it's about storytelling, it's about influence, and it's about creating a pull system. So the people need to want the change and have some stake in the change and want to own it, right? And so coming in, having an external speaker come in, give a talk that might be inspiring to some could be a way. Finding that, I mean, one of the things that I would do when I was at one company is I would give a talk. I was coaching 50 teams, and then some of the teams would like be interested, and then I'd work with those teams, and then I'd get somebody from that team to go up on a stage, and then things would spread. There's different ways to bottom up spread. You can try that top down imposing change thing.
You need some grassroots too.
I think you do. And it gets back to your point earlier about coming from the top down, coming from the bottom up. And I think really including people, involving people, getting people to pull and want something is what we need to do to influence. Because, yeah, it. Otherwise, it's a different kind of challenge. And
yeah. Well, thank you so much, Heidi. Yeah. This has been a wonderful conversation. Really appreciate your time. Enjoyed the book. The book is Dynamic Reteaming. Definitely recommend our listeners check it out. If our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about the work that you do, where can they find you, Heidi?
Yeah, you could connect with me on LinkedIn, Heidi Helfand. You could go to HeidiHelfand.com. And yeah, looking forward to hearing from people. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Heidi.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.